don't think about a pink elephant. I think I know what you're thinking about, a pink elephant. This illustrates why it's easier said than done not to worry about your sleep, you know?
Welcome to the Sleep to Healthy. I'm your instructor, Dennis Trumpy, and this is lesson number 7 of the Sleep to Healthy, How to Cure Your Insomnia class. This lesson is titled Sleep Myths, Unlearning Sleep. In the last lesson, you studied Sleep Buddy, where you discovered how to improve your relationship with sleep and turn your sleep adversary into your sleep buddy and actually look forward to bedtime and sleep. Today's lesson will cover the third element of CBTI, or Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, sleep myths. Your insomnia has been caused by two forces. The first is the incorrect behaviors you have adopted to cope with your insomnia. These were dealt with in the past two lessons on compact sleep and Sleep Buddy. But sleep is a function of the mind, so we must be attentive not just to your patterns of behavior, but also the incorrect thoughts and decisions of the mind. So this and the next lesson will be focus on beliefs and thoughts more than on actions. When CBTI first evolved some 40 years ago, computers, the internet, and sleep science were all in their infancy. Sleep myths dealt mainly with misunderstandings about sleep on a personal level, that is, your individual reaction to your sleep. For instance, your belief that you should stay in bed longer to sleep more, or worrying that tomorrow would be a disaster because you were awake in the middle of the night. I will call these mind myths, as they are sleep myths that you generate in your mind from your own personal experience with sleep. Then along came the information explosion, and a new class of myths created a new generation of insomniacs and made it even harder for you to overcome your insomnia. These are the myths created by misinformation in the media. An example of a media myth is that you need 8 hours of sleep a night, a myth that we thoroughly extinguished in Lesson 2 and 3. Another is that your health will suffer horribly if you have insomnia, an issue we resolved in Lesson 3 on insomnia. Unfortunately, with media myths, bad news, whether true or not, tends to catch on like wildfire and is difficult to extinguish. Even after the initial outburst of inaccurate information dies down, it soon appears somewhere else and continues to spread. I will refer to these as media myths. So to sleep well, you will need the tools and knowledge to deal with both mind myths and media myths. There are two characteristics that these two groups have in common. The first is that they are half-truths. They have a grain of truth, but not the whole truth. Because they don't give the whole picture, they are myths. The second is that they can cause stress and anxiety. Negative emotions, especially stress and anxiety, are sleep killers. In fact, stress and anxiety play such a major role in insomnia that many sleep experts see insomnia as a manifestation of hyperarousal, period. They find in working with hundreds and thousands of people with insomnia that in nearly all cases, if they can help with the hyperarousal and hyper-anxiousness, then the insomnia disappears. So it will pay for you to be especially attentive to this lesson on sleep myths, not dealing effectively with your stress-inducing sleep myths is the number one issue that you will likely deal with in successfully completing this CBTI, or Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, program. Compacting Your Sleep and Sleep Buddy are difficult to implement, but the process is pretty straightforward. It just takes fortitude and persistence. Sleep myths is the most nuanced and difficult to master. That is because, as you will find, it is full of contradictions and it takes skill and practice not to be misled. So let's start with media myths. This is not part of a normal CBTI or cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia program, but I think you will find it especially helpful. In the many, many hours I spend researching material for this course, I read many books. I'm in the middle of a New York Times best-selling book on sleep right now. The author is a highly regarded sleep expert and appears on all the top American talk shows. The book is exceedingly well-written, entertaining, it's packed full of fascinating information about sleep. But from the moment I read the first page, my blood was boiling. Why? My anger starts with the opening paragraph, where the author gives a dire warning that two-thirds of us fail to get the recommended 8 hours of sleep. By now, you should know how I feel about this 8-hour sleep fallacy. I believe the author has good intentions to educate the public about the importance of sleep, but in my opinion, throughout the book, entertainment overshadows accuracy, and time again, readers are misled by half-truths. Most of these half-truths will elicit anxiety and fear in readers such as you, as you are led to believe that if you're not getting 8 hours of high-quality sleep daily, your world will implode. The likely impact of this book is to produce many, many people with insomnia, and readers already suffering from insomnia will find their symptoms worsen, not improve. This highly popular book, like nearly all articles on sleep, give one side of the story and draw conclusions where none are warranted. Maybe I should write the author a letter thanking him for a boatload of students in my class on curing your insomnia. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox and we can continue with the course. To deal with media myths, it helps to have some perspective on how the world of science works. I have worked in the area of science most of my life and have run many experiments. I have a reasonable understanding of statistics, experimental design, and especially the limitations of scientific results. I even listened to a podcast on statistics, for goodness sakes. To show how easy it is to be misled, even if you are knowledgeable, I misnamed my podcast. When I first started this project, I bought into the myth that poor sleep led to all sorts of dire health outcomes, and so I named it Sleep to Healthy. But after extensive reading and talking to many sleep experts, I came to realize that it shouldn't be Sleep to Healthy. It should be Sleep to Feel and Function Well. I've since changed the logo and much of the information on the website, but for now I'm reluctant to change the name as it takes a long time to build a following on the internet. So, if you occasionally fall victim to misleading information on sleep, you are in good company. In any case, in Lesson 4, which was an overview of CBTI, we learned that you don't cure insomnia with sleep facts. You conquer insomnia with changes in your behavior and your thoughts. So, here is my advice on handling media myths. The first is for you to start ignoring headlines and articles. Don't click on that sleep or insomnia headline, regardless of how enticing. People who write these articles and headlines want eyeballs. truth is, usually of secondary importance. Unless you are trained in scientific methods and willing to dig into the facts by finding and analyzing the original source of information, ignore every article and headline you come across, at least until your insomnia is cured. The bad easily outweighs any good that you are likely to achieve by clicking through. Everything you need to cure your insomnia is in this course. So for now at least, restrict your media diet. Let's hear from Dr. Daniel Erickson and his concept of a sleep information detox.
The first steps towards sleeping better are typically pretty straightforward using CBTI. However, once you've mastered the core techniques, the second step is more difficult. That's letting go of preoccupations, worrying less, thinking less about sleep. But a good place to start may be a sleep detox. A lot of people out there know the basics. You know, you understand bedtime restriction. You know that spending less time in bed is important as a first step towards sleeping better because that builds a sleep drive. You understand the concept of sleep drive. You understand stimulus control, leaving the bed when you are frustrated in bed and can't fall asleep, not to associate the bed with sleep. Now, those first steps for many people are enough. Bedtime restriction, stimulus control are often enough for people. But when that is insufficient, the next step is the hard one. That is, you know, letting go of preoccupations, worrying less, not thinking about sleep, like disengaging from you know, the whole process of trying to sleep better. That is the really hard part with CBTI. And a good place to stay, take a step back and to kind of like take a further step towards sleeping better may be a sleep detox. Committing 2 weeks to not engaging at all in any like type of online or other search for information, meaning you go off Reddit, you know, you don't Google anything about sleep, you don't read anything about sleep in a textbook or anything else, you just completely kind of detox from like all this information that may be not helpful for you, that may be like clogging up your system in a lack for a better word. So cleansing yourself for, let's say, 2 weeks, being completely off the grid in terms of like sleep, may be something that could be helpful.
The second thing, should you decide to ignore my rule number one, or if you have some advice you have already absorbed from the media that you just can't shake, is to educate yourself on how to think critically about the article you read. I am going to give you a few tips that will tear apart nearly every article you are likely to read, and you don't need to be a sleep scientist. When you are reading something about sleep, ask these questions. First, ask yourself if this is a case of causation or correlation. Causation means that A causes B. Smoking causes cancer. There is a logical and provable link between the chemicals in smoke and the reaction of the highly exposed lung tissue. Remember this. It took decades for science to prove this causation to a point that public policy decisions were made. Yes, there were powerful industry lobby groups, but it took a long time for science to plug all the loopholes in the scientific experiments. This should remind you that proving causation is exceedingly difficult to achieve, and in strict scientific terms is never achievable to a 100% level. So anytime you hear a claim that anything sleep-related causes anything, be extremely, extremely skeptical. It is very hard to prove that A causes B, that lack of sleep causes anything. The cousin of causation, A causes B, is correlation. A is correlated to B. This means that A and B appear to be in tandem or in harmony. When A goes up, B goes up. When A goes down, B goes down. For instance, cancer is correlated to the number of ashtrays in a home. The more ashtrays in a home, the more likely the occupants are to get cancer. But ashtrays don't cause cancer, but they are correlated. Sleep is especially susceptible to this misinterpretation because many factors that cause poor sleep also affect your health. For instance, sleep apnea, where you stop breathing many times throughout the night, impacts your sleep and your health. The same goes for stress, pain, heart problems, and many other conditions that cause both sleep problems and health problems. Sleep isn't the cause of the health issue, it is just one of the symptoms. It would be like having a head cold and blaming your sore throat on your runny nose. They're just both symptoms of a third factor, your microbial infection. Training yourself to notice the difference between causation and correlation will help you in all your consumption of media. Look for the word causes in the article, not in the headline. If they don't specifically say causes, then assume it is a correlation, because causation is like gold to the media, and they will use it whenever they can. Another thing you can look at is how big the study was that the headlines are being based on. Doing research is expensive. The bigger the study, the higher the cost. So scientists try to glean the most information from the fewest participants. This is fine to test an idea to see if it has some merit. It's a misuse when you start drawing unjustified conclusions. As an example, I want to see how wearing a blue shirt affects my coin tosses. I wear my blue shirt, and I flip the coin 3 times and observe the outcome. I see that I got 2 heads, and so I conclude that wearing a blue shirt results in getting more heads. In this experiment, I have a 100% chance of getting at least 2 heads or 2 tails. This is an extreme case of what small studies do. They exaggerate outcomes. Coin tossing is as simple as you can get. Real life with complex brains, behaviors, demographics, cultures, health conditions, to name but a few of the many confounding factors, are very complex and require multiple studies involving thousands of people by many independent researchers in depth to reach any reliable conclusions. These are few and far between, so most findings can be safely ignored. Don't give a research finding more credibility than it deserves. Look for how many participants there were. If they don't say, assume it was a small, inaccurate study. A related issue is that negative results seldom get reported. This means that if research shows that sleep does not cause a problem, you'll probably never hear about it. Also, there might be other studies that refute the findings of the one you're reading, but they either get ignored or don't get published. So just be highly skeptical about any conclusions that you read about. And my third recommendation is to ask who was studied and how closely they resemble you. Young people respond differently to sleep issues than older people. Healthy people respond differently than less healthy people. Males respond differently than females. Different cultures and races can respond differently. So the first thing to ask is who they did the study on, and do they resemble you? Likely not. As a person who currently has insomnia, there are 2 classes you should be particularly aware of. First is that good sleepers respond differently than those with insomnia. Most studies on sleep and health recruit good sleepers. That is not you, at least not right now. As a person with insomnia, you develop coping skills to deal with your sleepless nights. People who sleep well don't. So when they disrupt a good sleeper's sleep, they're going to respond differently than you will. The second is that there's a huge difference between disrupting a healthy sleeper's sleep and having a poor night's sleep as a result of a personal situation, whether caused by stress or a physical factor such as pain. Disrupting sleep is done externally without regard to the person's sleep pattern. It's artificial. Insomnia is a natural response to a stressor. For instance, with sleep disruption, you may be woken during deep sleep, whereas with insomnia, you awake when your sleep is at a later stage or during a normal nocturnal awakening. One of my favorite examples of how results from participants in a study is applied to an unrelated group is in a recent research that an important function of sleep is to flush the brain of chemicals responsible for Alzheimer's in the brain. The conclusion is that poor sleep equals Alzheimer's, a finding sure to strike fear in the heart of many of us. When I dug into it, it was research done on a few mice. Going from a healthy young rodent with a puny brain to conclusions about an elderly human being seems a bit premature, don't you think? So don't compare apples to oranges. If they're testing apples and you're an orange, ignore the results. And the fourth and final line of critical thinking is to keep in mind that sleep is of the mind, not of the body. Any conclusions that indicate negative outcomes for the body from lack of sleep likely don't hold much water. Yes, there is some common connection. Growth hormones are released during sleep, and your sleeping mind will discourage bowel movements in the middle of your sleep. But sleep is primarily about the brain consolidating memories. That should give you enough for now. Bottom line, ignore all articles on sleep. I would recommend ignoring them for life, but certainly at least while you're on this CBTI program. I interviewed Dr. Neil Stanley, an author and highly prolific tweeter. I will put a link in the Sleep to Healthy website to his Twitter feed. He gives a daily critique of sleep myths in the media that you might find helpful if you have trouble shaking the media sleep myths. So let's move on to mind myths, which is really at the heart of CBTI. If you are familiar with CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, then you might have felt at a loss so far as how the first two elements of CBTI don't resemble anything in CBT. You will find this section on mind myths is closer to the CBT that you know and love. As mentioned earlier, many sleep experts consider insomnia a hyperarousal or hyperanxiety issue. CBT was developed to help people with depression and anxiety issues. Since sleep is severely affected by stress and anxiety, it's a natural fit to use some of the principles of CBT to cure insomnia. First, I will review with you the powerful impact stress and anxiety have on your sleep and how it fits into the CBT model. Next, I will review the CBT model of observed thoughts, emotions, and actions, and how it can lead you down a fruitful or harmful path. This model was covered in Lesson 4 on The Strange World of CBTI. You might want to revisit Lesson 4's page on sleepthehealthy.com, as there are some helpful diagrams on this model that make it easier to understand, better than anything I can explain verbally. And finally, I will give you some powerful hands-on CBT tools that help you get off your destructive paths and get you onto more helpful and healthy ways of dealing with sleep. An essential ingredient of good sleep is an absence of fear. If your brain senses danger, it's not going to let you go into and stay in the vulnerable sleep state. Emotions related to fear include fearful, anxious, stressful, tense, discouraged, powerless, alarmed, cautious, nervous, scared, angry, apprehensive, abandonment, vulnerable. If you are feeling any of these emotions, you are likely going to have a hard time sleeping. We are going to deal with how to disengage your fear response in this and the next lesson. But first, we are going to have to deal with the sleep better paradox. I am going to explain why pink elephants might be stopping you from sleeping well. It is part of the great cure insomnia paradox. It is why most sleep solutions don't work, and the one reason why you might fail at CBTI. So listen carefully. If I ask you not to think of a pink elephant, you can't help but to think of a pink elephant. If I ask you to think of a blue duck, a pink elephant won't even occur to you. A big part of the solution to your insomnia is stop thinking about the pink elephant, which is sleep. Instead, start thinking about the blue duck, which is focusing on being relaxed, not sabotaging your sleep, and how you are feeling and functioning. This is the great paradox of curing your insomnia.
In order to sleep better, you have to focus on your sleep.
But
by focusing on your sleep, it'll create sleep anxiety, which hinders good sleep.
I have a great diagram that explains it much better than I can do justice orally on at mysleepthehealthy.com website. Here is how the great insomnia paradox goes.
If you try to sleep better, you focus on your sleep. You measure your success by how well you sleep and how many hours of sleep you get. This creates sleep anxiety, which your brain interprets as fear, and the brain won't sleep well in a state of fear. So any methods or potions that you use will end in failure.
On the other hand,
if you don't think about sleep and don't change your harmful thoughts and actions, your insomnia won't go away.
So you're stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Work on your sleep and fail,
or don't work on your sleep and fail.
It just seems like
there's no
way out.
The resolution to the paradox is to focus on the things that result in a mind that is conducive to sleep, and let the mind decide what to do, which most times, but not always, will be to sleep. The goal goes from sleeping well to feeling and functioning better, which is why you want to sleep well anyway, right? The end goal is to not to have to give sleep a moment's thought. Just let it happen. The work ahead of you is to improve your habits, thoughts, and emotions for their own sake. Don't you feel better when you follow good habits? Don't you feel and function better in a state of relaxation than of stress? Wouldn't you rather have positive emotions than negative emotions? You achieve this by taking the position of an impartial observer rather than the person caught up in the emotions of frustration, anxiety, and stress. It's like the difference between watching a rainstorm from the inside of a dry shelter rather than standing out in the rain and getting soaked. It still rains. Sometimes life sucks. But you can gain a sense of detachment, which lessens the impact and allows you to make better decisions and take wiser actions. When you stop trying to control sleep, but create a mind that is ready for sleep, an amazing thing happens. Your brain does what it's designed to do. It sleeps. This paradox is part of what makes this course difficult to teach. I have to focus on sleep in order to get you to stop focusing on sleep. I hope that I'm having some measure of success. So let's stop focusing on the pink elephant and let's follow the blue duck, shall we? Here is Dr. Daniel Erickson's take on the pink elephant paradox.
Don't think about a pink elephant. I think I know what you're thinking about, a pink elephant. This illustrates why it's easier said than done not to worry about your sleep. You know, the more we worry about sleep, like the more we think about sleep, like how am I going to sleep tonight? I didn't sleep. I just slept 2 hours yesterday. And what's going to happen if I don't sleep tonight? Am I never going to sleep, et cetera, et cetera. The more heightened, you know, our alertness is, the more worried we become and the less we sleep. Now, the problem is, you know, if somebody tells you, don't think about a pink elephant, you think about a pink elephant. Same thing, like if somebody tells you, don't worry about your sleep, then you worry about your sleep. Like that's hard. So what can you do? Well, journaling, I think, is probably the kind of most straightforward way you can start to deal with this. And one way of journaling is, you know, setting off time an hour or so before your bedtime, setting off like 15 minutes to like write down all the things you worry about. That's very straightforward. Another way you can do that is if you have these kind of recurrent thoughts, recurrent worries, is you do the same thing, but instead of just listing the things that worry you, you write down the thing that worries you or that you're worried about. And then you write down like a couple of possible solutions. That's, you know, one way of journaling. And I guess I'll mention one more, which is you can write down like what the thought was and like you're worried about, how likely that is to happen, and what you're going to do if that happens. So just kind of giving you some ideas. Those are kind of some ways of journaling. So you can deal with like worrying and like obsessive, like recurrent thoughts.
And here's another perspective on the sleep paradox issue.
When you are looking to move past your insomnia, the goal should not be to get 8 hours, but to be happy and feel great. The former leads you into a spiral of self-monitoring and more sleeplessness. The latter leads to a place of fantastic sleep. I get a lot of emails and messages from people that are asking how they will get to this amount of sleep or why they're only getting this amount of sleep. And that, I'm realizing more and more, is a very, very, very big problem. Because if your goal, using cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, when you're using these techniques, CBTI, to get better sleep, if your goal is to get, let's say, 7.5 hours of sleep, then the whole process, everything you do, you will monitor how much you're sleeping. You will be checking, okay, I got 4.5 hours yesterday and I only got 4 today. Why am I not reaching 7.5? You know, this whole process, the goal leads you to this self-monitoring. It leads to clock watching. It leads to evaluating and strategizing and focusing on the insomnia. And you need to go in the complete opposite direction. Insomnia feeds off of attention. Attention is its oxygen. You cannot give it any attention. Therefore, the goal has to be to feel refreshed, to be happy, and just feel good. When that becomes the goal, that takes away attention from insomnia. You're no longer checking how many times of sleep you got, how that aligns to your goal. You're taking attention away from insomnia. And when you do that, when you start taking attention away from insomnia, it cannot survive. It needs attention to thrive. So please, 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 please make your goal to feel good, you know? And some of you may be thinking like, how am I supposed to do that when I also am supposed to like keep track of my sleep and keep a sleep diary? Well, you can do both. You can still kind of guesstimate how much you sleep, and that can be helpful, you know. But much more important, in that sleep diary, if you're keeping one, then make sure to write down how you're feeling and keep track of like how alert you feel, how happy you are, and how overall well you feel. That, you know, focusing on that is the path to moving past insomnia.
You can measure something, but not make it your goal. I could measure how many steps I take to walk from here to the store, but it doesn't mean that I have a goal of a certain number of steps. A successful trip to the store is returning with the proper groceries, not how many steps I took. The number of steps, it's just information. When you record information about your sleep, You do so to get information that you can use to make decisions to adjust your behavior or thoughts. In fact, the only time you need to know how much sleep you got is when you're compacting your sleep and you need to set a goal for bed duration. Other than that, measuring how much sleep you're getting serves no useful purpose, and as Dr. Erickson says, can become extremely counterproductive. So I would just measure sleep when you're compacting your sleep. Other than that, who cares? If you're feeling subpar, irritable, and sleepy, you know you're not getting enough sleep. Whether you're out by a half hour or 3 hours really doesn't matter. It just means that you need to adjust your actions and thoughts as instructed by CBTI. And as Dr. Erickson says, if you keep a sleep journal, remember that life is more than just about sleep. Make comments about how you're feeling about life in general. This will more accurately point you in the correct direction for change. For instance, if you're feeling more hopeful and in control, then you're on the right path and you can continue with what you're doing. If you're feeling irritable, depressed, and find it hard to focus, then you need to make adjustments in your CBTI protocols. CBTI is no magic bullet in this regard. Any of the CBTI elements may trigger anxiety for you due to your specific situation and life history. If you sense anxiety, adjust what you're doing or drop the CBTI technique. It might just not work for you at this time. This is where working with a sleep professional can help. As examples, some people find relaxation techniques stressing. Some people fail miserably at compacting their sleep because they find it stress-inducing. Always let your body and mind's response be your guide. There is not a single activity that will be relaxing for everyone, but everyone can find activities that are relaxing. You just may need to get a little creative. That is why CBTI advises you to relax before bedtime, but does not prescribe a particular method. You will have to find your own groove. The irony is that anytime you find yourself doing something to sleep better, drop it, or proceed with extreme caution. See if you can't adjust your motivation. Rather than taking chamomile tea to sleep well, take it to relax and enjoy yourself. If it stops becoming relaxing and enjoyable, then try something else. Don't make the decision based on your sleep. Disconnect the activity from sleep. The thing that makes the solution to sleeping well hard to grasp is that most of our goals in life are achieved by focused effort on the goal and the activities that lead to the goal. Get fit by going to the gym. Lose weight by willing yourself to eat healthily. Gain a proficiency by practicing for 10,000 hours, and so forth. But sleep is of the mind, not the body. So it doesn't work that way. As we covered in the last lesson, Sleep Buddy, it's more like a personal relationship than a physical object. The sleep process is so deeply embedded into our brains from many millions of years of evolution that we have virtually no direct control over it. It literally has a mind of its own. Your sleep system is going to take in a wide variety of factors and decide if and when it will allow the brain to go to sleep. There's no point in fighting it, so you might as well just accept it. CBTI can be a way out of the paradox. Focus on your unhelpful behaviors, which we covered in lessons 5 and 6. Focus on reducing stress for its own sake, which we cover in this lesson and the next. And don't do things to sabotage your sleep, which we cover in the final lesson. Note that CBTI does not try to control sleep. It aligns your habits with your natural sleep rhythms. Then it reduces stress and avoids destructive habits. Sounds like a plan to me. Now it is time to turn to the world of CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, that CBTI is based upon. As a quick primer to CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT was developed in the 1980s as a merging of two earlier therapies. It has been shown to be very effective in treating depression, anxiety disorders, and many other mental health issues. It is particularly relevant to CBTI in its application of reducing anxiety. Many sleep experts classify long-term, chronic insomnia as primarily an anxiety or hyperarousal disorder. In fact, it's highly unlikely that your insomnia is a pathological condition. That is, that there is something broken. You don't get surgery to cure insomnia. Other than melatonin, which can help adjust your circadian rhythm, nothing you take changes the chemistry or neural programming in your brain. Curing insomnia means improving your actions and thoughts, period. Don't make it into something bigger than it is. Let's start with the CBT model, which says observations, thoughts, feelings, and actions. In other words, observations lead to your thoughts, which lead to an emotional response, which leads to the action that you take. I have a diagram of this on my sleepthehealthy.com website. It's easier to visualize and understand with the diagram, so you might be well served to check that out. The observation, thought, feelings, action model means that you observe something. This leads to you thinking about it, which leads to your emotional response, and then you take action based on your thoughts and emotions. Let me illustrate the model for you with an example. Starting with the observation stage, let's say that you observe or notice that you're not sleeping well, and that you feel sleepy, irritable, and foggy during the day. Your thoughts are how you interpret what you noticed. You judge being sleep-deprived as bad for your health. You anticipate that your work will suffer, and you dwell on how your irritability will impact important relationships. This leads to your emotional reaction, which is to feel frustrated, worried, anxious, fearful. Given your thoughts and your feelings, you decide to try harder to sleep by going to bed earlier and rigidly following advice from the internet on how to sleep better. The result of these actions leads back to the first step, observation. You now observe that your sleep is getting worse, not better, and that your irritability is starting to harm your important relationships. And so the downward cycle continues. The CBT approach is that you can intervene in two places. First, you can intervene in the thought stage. In this case, you could replace the thoughts with thoughts like, loss of sleep doesn't affect my health much, and I can do fine at work even if I'm not feeling 100%, and I can handle a few days of not feeling great. Now that you're learning about CBTI, you could also add the thought, I know what to do about this. I need to work on compacting my sleep, or perhaps, I'm stressed out right now from that assignment at work. Not sleeping well is a normal response to this stress. It'll pass as the situation at work gets resolved. Having these more accurate and more helpful thoughts means that your emotions can be less negative and even positive, which reduces your fear-related emotions. The second place to intervene is your actions or behavior. Rather than trying harder to sleep, you can take steps to correct any issues with your lifestyle not being in tune with your sleep pressure, your circadian rhythm, your levels of anxiety, or any insomnia-causing situations you have. You will not try to control your sleep, but rather take care of your sleep drivers and let sleep take care of itself. Using this CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, model of observe, thought, emotion, reaction, you can catch yourself thinking unhelpful thoughts or taking unhelpful actions and self-correct. The second aspect of CBTI was demonstrated in the example in the thoughts stage. Perhaps you've heard the Cherokee legend of the grandparent and their grandchild. The wise sage explains to their grandchild how they have two wolves living at war inside of them. One wolf is just, courageous, wise, temperate, calm, and kind towards themselves and others. The other wolf inside them is cruel, cowardly, selfish, emotional, and unjust. These two wolves are constantly battling for control of the person's minds and actions. The grandchild asks their grandparent, "What determines which wolf wins the war?" The wise grandparent replies, "The one you feed." In CBT, cognitive distortions, or reframing, is about replacing unhelpful, untrue statements with helpful and more true statements. You want to feed the more helpful wolf with truer, more helpful statements. Neurologically, every time you think a negative, unhelpful thought, neural connections are strengthened and reinforced, and the thought pattern gets stronger. Over time, it can be exceedingly difficult, perhaps sometimes impossible, to unwire the brain. Each time you catch the unhelpful thought and replace it with a more true, more helpful thought, the original undesirable neural pathway is weakened. Over time, the better thought replaces the unwanted thought, and you can proceed along the correct path effortlessly. But rewiring the brain takes focused work and it takes time. The brain is not like a computer that can be reprogrammed in an instant. It is organic, not directly controlled, and it takes time and effort. In this CBTI course, you're learning the truth about sleep. But the media and your previous experience with sleep is trying to convince you otherwise. Reframing is about the process of replacing the unhelpful, less true statements with more helpful, truer statements and beliefs. One way people have found helpful to make this transition is to give that part of your mind that feeds the undesirable wolf a name. By naming that part of your mind, you are given a degree of control, influence, and detachment. You can give it any name you want, such as George or Sally, or it could be a descriptive name like my negative self or the darkness. When you notice your mind feeding the unwanted wolf with thoughts such as, I'll never be able to sleep well, or tomorrow will be horrible, you simply call yourself on it by saying to yourself, there goes Sally again, trying to persuade me with those lies, or I'm noticing that my negative self is trying to take me away from CBTI. You could try this technique and see if it's helpful for you. Another way to change your unhelpful and less accurate thoughts is to write out and say aloud the more accurate and more helpful thoughts that you are trying to replace it with. The more ways you experience the better thoughts and beliefs, the more firmly and the more quickly they will be entrained in your mind. In practical terms, if you just think the better thought, your brain has one impression, the thought. If you write it out and speak it out, you have the thought, the physical action of writing, visually seeing it on paper, the audible sensation of hearing it, and the action of speaking it. This gives your brain five impressions rather than one and will speed up the learning process. This is not a one-time exercise. You may have to repeat writing down the better thoughts many, many times before they become a habit. Regardless, replacing your entrenched beliefs will take time and effort. Just listening to this lesson will not cut it. To help you, I put some CBT worksheets on my sleepthehealthy.com website. These sheets are designed to, one, help you have a more impartial, accurate view of your anxiety-producing situation. 2, reduce your anxiety level. 3,
give you some positive countermeasures, and 4, give you positive feedback on progress. You can use these sheets anytime, including in the middle of the night if you're having trouble sleeping. There are several sheets, and the most comprehensive sheet has 7 columns, so I will go over those here. Column 1 is for naming the situation. Let us imagine that you are up at night and you can't get to sleep. In column 1, you might write, "I'm up at night and can't get to sleep." Column 2 is for measuring your negative emotions. In this case, you might feel anxious and give it an 8 out of 10, where 10 is extremely high and 0 is non-existent. You might also be feeling fearful at a 8.5 out of 10 level. You will want to focus on levels that are 4 or 5 or higher, levels that cause issues, not levels that really have no consequences. Column 3 is for your thoughts that underlie the negative emotions. Here you might write, "Tomorrow will be a disaster," or "I have to get back to sleep soon because I only have 3 hours left before the alarm." Don't try to use reason at this point. Even irrational thoughts that cause highly negative emotions should be named. You don't need to go crazy and catch every emotion and every thought. Just name a few and proceed. You will find that by addressing one thought or emotion, the others are diminished automatically, so you don't need to be especially thorough. It's better to make it shorter and do this exercise more often than to hammer out every single little detail, but only do it twice a year. The 4th column is for evidence of the thoughts. What has happened in your life that would lead you to this thought? In this case, you might write, "I've had bad days at work before after a bad sleep," and "I've had nights before where I didn't get back to sleep." Column 5 is for evidence against the thought. This is a turning point that starts to lead you out of your negative spiral. Appropriate responses might be, "I've had horrible night's sleep before and still done quite well at work," and "just because I might not feel great tomorrow doesn't mean that my performance and interactions are out of my control. I can still handle it, even if I feel suboptimal. And I normally get back to sleep when I'm awake. It's more likely that I'll get back to sleep than it is that I'll be awake for the rest of the night, especially if I practice my CBTI techniques." It's important that you don't write out pie-in-the-sky, unrealistic statements. They should be as true or truer than the evidence you wrote in column 4. For example, writing, "If I put my mind to it, I can do anything. I will go back to bed and get right back to sleep," probably isn't realistic or helpful. If you get stuck on finding evidence against your thought, ask yourself what a good friend would say, or what someone who sleeps well might say. If you need help, you could try sending me a line, and I can see what I can do to help you as well. Column 6 is for adaptive thoughts. These are the helpful thoughts that you could use to replace the negative thoughts in column 3. Again, they should be true or truer than the thoughts in column 3. So you could write, "I may not feel 100% tomorrow, but I can still perform well and enjoy others' company." And, "I'm going to get my mind off the clock, cover up the clock, and use the sleep buddy approach." The final column might hold a surprise for you the first time you use it. Here, you write out the negative emotions that you listed in column 2, along with their current level of intensity. You should be pleasantly surprised at how much your emotional intensity can drop in just a few minutes of writing. In this case, the anxiety fell from an 8 to a 3, and the fear dropped from an 8.5 to a 5.5.
Over time, you will notice the negative emotions melting away as you work your way across the columns. Getting this feedback is vital for motivating you to repeat the process. I will also give you a hint. The more you don't feel like completing this exercise, the more you need it, and the more you will benefit from it. It is vitally important that you write out the process and not try to do it just mentally. The effect, it's just not the same, and the impact will be greatly diminished if you try to take the easy way out. There's something magical about pen to paper or typing it out. Ideas and perceptions are released that stay hidden when trying to do the exercise mentally. I've put some worksheets with examples on my sleeptohealthy.com website to help you through the process. And again, there are many ways to contact me through the website if you have any questions about this. Michael Schwartz has an alternative method that you might find helpful.
Today I want to talk about the other side of relaxation, which is the mental side, calming the mind down. This is kind of a big topic, but there are some really simple things that anyone can do to help with this very common problem of an active, sometimes worrisome mind at night. So first, I just want to talk real generally about how the brain changes from day and wake to night and sleep. So the part of your brain that is very active during the day, your prefrontal cortex, that's the front part of your brain, it's helping you with all of your logical, rational thinking all day long. And it takes a lot of energy to run that part of your brain. A lot of glucose metabolism happens there and things like that. So that part of your brain uses a lot of energy all day long. Well, one of the big reasons for sleep is that your body is conserving energy. Your metabolism slows. You're not expending as much energy. So no surprise, that part of your brain kind of goes offline early. Your body starts to shut it down. And so you're not thinking as rationally or logically as you might during the day. There's also another part of your brain, your limbic system, and certain structures in your limbic system, like your amygdala you may have read about. It tends to be involved with your fear and emotional reactions. That part of your brain, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, it tends to get a little more active at night. So you have kind of an uphill battle right from the start with this whole idea of having a calm, relaxed mind. And this is something that a lot of people have experienced. As the evening goes on into the night, their mind gets more active, more worrisome. Small worries or concerns can start to get bigger and bigger. And that's even led to some old sayings you may have heard about, like never make a big decision at night, or any problem at 2 in the afternoon is always going to seem bigger at 2 in the morning. These phrases were probably born out of the realization that people had a long time ago that they didn't think as rationally or logically at night as they did during the day. Okay, so then the question is, what can you do about it, if anything? Well, in all the years I've been helping people with their sleep, the simple suggestions tend to be the best. They tend to be the ones that work most of the time, and they work for the long run. They're not just little gimmicky things. And very simply, the suggestion I like for an active, worrisome mind at night is to write things down during the day. So during the day, when you're thinking more clearly, more logically, more rationally, you get some things down on paper, that things that might be commonly on your mind at night, in which you're ruminating about, you're worried about, they can seem overwhelming during the night. Take a few minutes at lunch, write some things down. I like the whole bullet point idea where it's very simply, here's the worry, and underneath the worry, you write down some things that you could potentially do to address the worry. Notice I didn't say solve the worry. I said address the worry. So here's an example that I use for pretty much all of my clients, and that is a worry might be they're worried about their sleep. That's a very common one. So a lot of people come to me because they're worried about their sleep. So things that someone could do to reduce the worry about sleep is talk to their doctor. That's a great place to start. They could go to good websites that have information about sleep. They could read a highly recommended book on sleep. They could listen to my podcast or go to my website. There's all kinds of things that you could do. And what's interesting is that they all involve gathering information. And that is really at the core of most worry or concern is lack of information. Even if a worry doesn't really have a clear or possible solution to it, simply gathering information helps reduce the degree of worry or concern. The classic example is someone gets a spot on their arm and they think it's cancer and their life's going to end soon and all that. So they're worried and they're anxious, and maybe they start to develop some trouble sleeping because of the anxiety. Well, what they've shown is really interesting, and that is even if that person then receives information that this spot on their arm is not good, it's cancerous, and it needs to be treated, even with information like that, worry and concern tends to go down because now they know what they're dealing with. It really boils down to a fear of the unknown. So when it comes to sleep, sleep is very mysterious. A lot of people don't know a lot about it. We kind of take it for granted, and then sometimes it gets difficult. But in general, people don't know a whole lot about it because you're not awake when it's happening by definition. So it just kind of happens. And you know, if you don't get enough, you don't feel as good as if you get enough, and things can disrupt it and noise and all kinds of stuff like that. But in our example for calming the mind down, gathering information about sleep, sleep education in a sense, is really a great way to reduce worry and concern over sleep. And this holds true with pretty much everything else that people might worry about during the night. Writing things down helps a person organize their thoughts during the day when they're thinking more clearly, and they can actually act on one of the things maybe they wrote down. So maybe they wrote down, go to a website to gather information about something, or talk to a friend about something, or do something in their home to find out about something that tends to be a worry or concern that's on their mind at night, keeping them awake. So this information gathering idea is probably the simplest and, in my experience, the best technique for helping to settle the mind at night. You can then go on from there and you can say, well, at night, you can tell yourself you did some good worrying during the day. You wrote some things down. It's safely documented on that piece of paper in your kitchen, and you can get to it tomorrow. You can worry more tomorrow. You become a little more in control of this whole idea of a worrisome mind at night, which if you ask people who struggle with this, these worries and concerns, they become a rumination. The same ones go round and round. They have to talk themselves through it each time, and it becomes very challenging where there's not a lot of boundary to it. And so this gives the person a simple strategy, a simple idea when they're thinking more clearly and they can act on one of the things. And of course, you want to keep things practical and rational and doable. So for example, if you're worried about your finances, you know, I wouldn't suggest writing ideas like I'm going to play the lottery every day and or start a Ponzi scheme and invite all my friends or rob my neighbor's house. I mean, I like to be silly to make points. And so the idea is that maybe a rational idea and perhaps doable thing would be to review your expenses from the last month and try to save X number of dollars this month. So you give yourself these little behavioral goals and you're working on them, and it gives you the peace of mind that you've got them documented literally off your mind and onto paper. And you can do that during the day, and you can get to that whenever you want during the day to work on some of these things that you wrote down. In rare cases, when a person goes through this exercise, it may bring up deep interpersonal things. So maybe they have relationship issues with a family member or a friend that really need more than just writing things down to help process through them. So maybe that leads to professional guidance, therapists and counselors who can be very helpful for people who really struggle with a lot of anxiety at night. But for anyone who's struggling with this active, worrisome mind at night, I do encourage them to explore writing things down during the day, not spending your whole day doing this. Maybe it's 10 minutes at lunch once in a while. Get a few ideas down on paper, get them off your mind, and see if that helps with calming the mind at night.
Although the impact can be speedy and effective, expect to fill in many worksheets. You have spent months or even years rehearsing your unhelpful thoughts. It will take more than one sheet to reverse the ingrained beliefs. But over time, you should find yourself using the sheets less and less frequently. As with all the CBTI skills, this skill will last you a lifetime, and you can always return to this exercise in the future should you revert back to your old and helpful ways and thoughts. There are many resources online, and many health professionals are familiar with CBT if you need additional help. If CBT does not seem to work well for you, there are alternatives. These include ACT, A-C-T, or Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. Also, The Work by Byron Katie. The Myth of Stress by Andrew Bernstein. Also, learning about Stoicism can be helpful. They all have the common theme of changing how we react in the world, but each uses a very different approach. Don't be afraid to experiment and find the mode that works best for you. I plan to cover these alternative methods in the final lesson, and I will have links to each one at the sleeptohealthy.com website. There has been a lot to take in this lesson. If you go to sleeptohealthy.com, you'll find helpful tools and diagrams and links. Whole books are devoted to CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, so it has been difficult to select which aspects would be most helpful to successfully execute CBTI. I would appreciate any feedback you can give me on how effective this lesson has been or not been for you. If you have experience with CBT, I would appreciate any improvements that you might suggest. The take-home message from this lesson is to identify your personal insomnia sleep myths and tackle them. The best way is to use the CBT worksheets on the sleeptohealthy.com website. This will be a great lesson to review anytime if you feel defeated by your insomnia. So, that's it for sleep myths. Today, I gave you the tools you need to rip apart any sleep myths that might be hindering your journey to a good night's sleep. You have a good understanding of the sleep paradox, how you need to focus on how well you are feeling, not how much sleep you're getting. You also have a worksheet that can help you put automatic negative thoughts, or ants, to rest. I want to remind you that if you want to do some of your own research on this CBTI, or Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia element, in CBTI terminology, sleep myths is called cognitive distortions. Everyone has stresses in their life. It is normal and healthy. But sometimes things build up and it puts pressure on your sleep. Wouldn't it be nice to have some tools that dissipate that pent-up stressor so you can relax, enjoy life, and sleep well? Listen to the next lesson to learn how.
I just always tell people that you cannot be anxious and relaxed at the same time. Most people who complain to me that they have trouble sleeping are experiencing some level of anxiety.
The assignment for today is to complete at least 3 of the CBT worksheets. It's better to tackle them initially when you are not feeling especially stressed out. So don't procrastinate and wait for a time when you feel out of control. Practice when things are calmer so you know what you're going to do under more pressing circumstances. A bonus assignment would be to use the critical analysis techniques that I talked about during the lesson on an article on sleep that you notice in the media. I'll put a worksheet with reminders of the technique on my sleeptohealthy.com website that you can use. Hey, and I would love to hear how you make out with these assignments. Send me a note using any of the 4 methods available on the website. Voice message, text message, email, or fill in the contact form. Let me know if you have any questions, what you find especially helpful, or even better, what you find frustrating with this course. Thank you for your feedback. And now my disclaimer, spoken in one breath. I hope it's obvious, but this podcast is not a substitute for advice from a qualified healthcare professional. The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and entertain. As we do not know your particulars, we cannot possibly provide professional or medical advice. Your use of the information in this podcast is at your own risk. You don't need tons of sleep trivia and people's opinions about sleep. You just need to know proven instructions on what you can do today to sleep better tonight so you can feel and function better tomorrow. This also allows you to repeat lessons, as it's hard to absorb all the information the first time through, and the information will make more sense after you've had the context of the whole course. You, like most people, will likely benefit from repeated listening. The lessons will be updated based on student feedback, so the next time you listen to the same lesson, it may be improved since the last time. And that's about it. Thanks for joining me in my sleep class. I look forward to seeing you again on the next episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast. See you then.